You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ernest Hemingway's first novel, The Sun Also Rises, has been called the quintessential story of the lost generation. It follows a group of expatriates from Paris in the 1920s to the bullfights in Spain and looks at the disillusionment of the post-World War I generation. It's The Leonard Lopate Show Book Club's latest selection, and Ernest Hemingway's grandson, Sean Hemingway, joins us now to discuss a new edition of the novel that's published by Scribner. It includes early drafts, deleted chapters, and notes that show the author's process. I'm very pleased to welcome Sean Hemingway back to our show. And we hope that our listeners, the ones who've been reading The Sun Also Rises, will join us in this conversation. If you have questions for Sean Hemingway, you can write to us on our show page or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You can also give us a call at 212-433-9692. Sean, how did you get involved in putting together this new edition?
Well, it really came out of my earlier work on A Movable Feast and A Farewell to Arms. And my uncle, Patrick Hemingway, my grandfather's second son, suggested we work on this book, which at first was a little daunting because it's such a major literary piece of my grandfather's writing.
A Movable Feast is a memoir. Did you learn a lot about your grandfather when you were revising that book?
I did. These projects have been incredibly interesting for me to learn about my grandfather and his writing and his life.
Aren't you a curator in Greek and Roman art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art?
That's right. That's my career is as a curator and an archaeologist.
Has that prepared you for doing this kind of work?
Well, in a funny way, it has. In that I've been looking at I'm as a scholar. I'm used to looking very carefully at manuscripts and literature. I started with Greek and Latin, of course.
And when you do archaeology, you consider everything to be important, even the things that might not seem important initially. Why did you want to include drafts and deleted chapters in this edition?
Well, I think it's very interesting to see the process of how my grandfather went about writing the book. And this is his first novel, so it's especially interesting, I think, to see how he approached it.
Did he save everything? Was everything in a box somewhere?
Remarkably, he did save it a tremendous amount. So I think actually the first draft of this was sitting in a trunk in the Ritz Hotel for many, many years, and he rediscovered it in the 1950s. And that was part of what inspired him to go back and start writing A Movable Feast.
What do the early drafts tell us about his writing style? Did he do a lot of editing to develop that signature style, the lean, spare prose that has influenced so many other artists?
You can see in the drafts how he cut a tremendous amount, and he worked towards that style, that lean, modern prose style that we've come to associate with him.
This was his first novel. Are there many drafts and notebooks for his other works as well?
There are. In working in A Farewell to Arms, it was fascinating how he rewrote the ending. He said he wrote it 39 times, and there were actually 47 drafts of the ending. So he rewrote a lot.
You include in this some photographs and even his fishing license for the Irrawaddy River and his bullfight tickets. He saved everything?
He saved a lot. He was what you might call a pack rat. He really did save these things, and I think they were memento mori, things that were reminded him of his travels and his times in Spain.
What was the origin of the novel? Was it inspired by his own experiences in France and Spain?
It was. I think that the novel is largely autobiographical, but he transformed those experiences into fiction very quickly, and you can see that in these drafts in the book.
Is he responsible for bringing the running of the bulls in Pamplona to the world's attention? Or is he to blame, some people might say?
He certainly is a major person responsible for it. He wrote a very interesting report on the running of the bulls for the Toronto newspaper in 1923. And at that time, he said he was the only American-speaking people there. It was Gertrude Stein who had actually introduced him to the bullfights, though, but he popularized them.
Why was he so drawn to the bullfights?
He
I mean, he wasn't the only American who was, but many Americans are horrified by them.
Yes, it's interesting. It was something that fascinated him, and he really he developed his passion for it and his what they call a fiction for it. As you know, he also wrote Death in the Afternoon about bullfighting, and then later at the end of his life also followed the bullfights.
The Sun Also Rises is called the quintessential novel of the lost generation. Where did that phrase come from, and what does it mean about Hemingway and about the characters in this book?
Well, it's the phrase is really comes to the world's attention in this book, and it's Gertrude Stein who told it to Hemingway when he was a young man, and he actually he added it as a epigraph to the novel at a very late stage, and you can see that in this new edition. And he had written a foreword about it, and where he describes, and it's really the earliest recollection of this account of Gertrude Stein talking to a garage owner in Paris about, and it's actually the garage owner who talks about the generation who fought in World War I as a lost generation, and how they can't work as mechanics.
Well, growing up in the wake of other wars like the Vietnam War, when did you first read this novel, and what were your impressions of it? Do you think that we've had a number of lost generations?
Well, I think the effects of war have unfortunately been felt by many generations since the time of the writing of the book. From World War I and on, there continues to be war throughout the world, unfortunately. So yes, I think it, and in that sense, it does speak to many generations.
Although this is taking place in the lead up to the Great Depression, but a boom time.
Mm-hmm. I think part of what's fascinating about the lost generation idea, and in the book, it's something that's not talked about except at the beginning with the quote from Gertrude Stein. It's a major theme of the book, but one that's not explicitly talked about.
The narrator, Jake Barnes, is a newspaper reporter in Paris, and he's a veteran of World War I, where he was badly wounded. Can you talk about how he was wounded and how his injury affects his life?
Jake Barnes, it's never described exactly how he was wounded in World War I, but he appears to have been emasculated.
He's intact, isn't he, but impotent?
Yes, he's impotent, but he seems to have lost his penis, but he has his testicles, according to one account from my grandfather in a later interview with George Plimpton. But in the book, it's not clear exactly. But he can feel love, but he can't consummate it.
Is his injury also symbolic to some extent?
It is. I think and many people have written about it. I think it has a symbolic sense, but it's a physical wound from World War I. It's not discussed in a great deal, but he is scarred by the war.
Do you think I'm sure it's not discussed as much as it might have been in a novel written today, just because of sensibilities of the time. But do you think that makes it even more effective?
I do. Because
our imaginations are also at work here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, no, I think I think that's one of the powers of my grandfather's writing is the understatement, which allows the reader to fill in themselves if the writing is done well enough, one feels that and sees it.
My guest is Sean Hemingway, who is the grandson of Ernest Hemingway. We're talking about Ernest Hemingway's first novel, The Sun Also Rises. It is this month's Leonard Lopate Show Book Club selection. And we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Jake tries to laugh about his injury, but it makes it impossible to be with the woman he loves. Brett, is it just the injury that keeps them apart, or is it also something about her?
Well, she is also damaged from the war. Her first love was killed during the war, and so she seems to have many liaisons, which are a big part of the book, and Jake is just one of them. And she doesn't seem to have recovered also from the war, and so she's looking for love, but she doesn't find it.
Well, she seems like an unusually liberated woman for the time. as you suggest, sleeping with whomever she wants, and she isn't apologetic about it. But to some degree, is that explained by the fact that she's also damaged?
I think I think in her case it is, because she is another damaged person by the war, and that's part of this lost generation that's the focus of the book.
In an early draft, one that didn't make it into the final book, Hemingway gave a fuller description of Rhett, that she doesn't have much in her life besides men and drinking, that she sometimes sat for portrait painters, but they never could capture her special allure.
There's wonderful passages that have been cut from the book as part of my grandfather's reductive process, and those are included in this new edition in the appendices, including passages, the two deleted chapters that were the beginning of the book that he cut at the advice of F. Scott Fitzgerald.
It begins with, in the first version, with a young bullfighter getting dressed in his hotel room. And he abandoned that because F. Scott Fitzgerald said that wasn't the way to start the book, that he should start instead with Robert Cohn, the middleweight boxing champion at Princeton.
Well, he had actually started the book as it's interesting. That's really before F. Scott Fitzgerald got involved. He started the book as a book about a bullfighter and the corruption of a bullfighter, and then he changed the emphasis as he wrote it to Brett and to Robert Cohen, and then he had the chapters start in Paris, and then it was when Fitzgerald saw the opening in Paris with "This is a story about a lady." And those are the deleted chapters that are included in this new edition that Fitzgerald suggested he revise significantly, and Hemingway actually just cut them.
In some notes, he refers to Cohn as the hero of the book. But is he the hero? Is there a hero in this book?
Well, I think he was grappling with that because he was writing his first novel, and traditionally a novel has a hero. But this book is really, in a sense, an important early modern work in that it doesn't really have a hero, and so he moved from character to character, and in the end, it doesn't really have a hero.
Well, what do you think his feelings are about Cohn? There's a fair amount of anti-Semitism in the book, more than in Hemingway's other works. Was this and Hemingway, according to a recent book that of his letters of the time, he found it pretty easy to make anti-Semitic remarks.
Well, I think there is the feeling, and certainly Cohen is portrayed in a very—he comes across very poorly in the novel.
He becomes unlikable and
yes.
Behaves badly.
Yeah, yeah, and I think my grandfather did have some anti-Semitism, and that comes across in his writing. But it was something that was part of his life. Unfortunately, at that time, and there are scholars like Michael Reynolds who did a whole book on this subject, looked at anti-Semitism at the time, and it was rampant, unfortunately.
Well, he was friends with Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot, who were anti-Semitic, but he was also, as you point out, a good friend of Gertrude Stein. She was a major influence on him.
Yes, no, he did have many friends, and I think he counted Harold Loeb, the man who is based, Robert Cohn is based on, as his friend as well. And in the novel, he makes him out to be worse than I'm sure he was, and the person that it was based on was. He referred to himself as Hemingstein too, so he joked about himself in a Jewish
well,
way.
Well, so much of what Hemingway was about was contradictions, the macho image, and then there was a very feminine side, being anti-Semitic and then calling yourself Hemingstein.
Yeah, he is a very a complex person with many contradictions, but many wonderful qualities.
My guest is Sean Hemingway, who wrote an introduction to a new edition of The Sun Also Rises, the Hemingway Library edition, with supplementary material, early drafts, and deleted chapters and photographs and other things. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Again, we invite you to participate by calling us at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wnyc.org, or by Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We are back with Sean Hemingway talking about The Sun Also Rises, his grandfather's first book. This is a new edition which includes all sorts of things that were deleted, and give us an insight into Hemingway's working process. But we also get the novel as we know it here. And that's important because in the end we see what made this book famous. Was it a success at the time? Because it comes out a year after The Great Gatsby. He was a friend of Fitzgerald's. Was he aware of Fitzgerald's book when this was being published?
He was. He had read Fitzgerald's book. He had met Fitzgerald in Paris in 1925. So he was up against Fitzgerald's book, The Great Gatsby, and he even joked to Fitzgerald after it came out that it could be called a Greater Gatsby. It was a success. As from the moment it came out, it was a success. So, and it was his first great success of a novel.
And did people see it as something different, as a modernist work?
They did. I think people were excited by it. I mean, his mother was not so excited about it because the characters and the promiscuity of Brett, I think she found shocking coming from an Oak Park background. But many people and reviewers in the New York Times and other places found it to be very important work.
A listener, Greg from Brooklyn, asks, was the character Brett based on a real person?
The characters, she was based on a real person, and it's remarkable that you can see in this new edition that the actual people on whom the characters were based, he uses their real names in the first draft. He changes that quite quickly, and he changes the events are quite different from the actual events of their time together in Pamplona in 1925.
Let's take a call from Chris from New Jersey. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you guys?
Well, what do you want to talk about?
So I recently reread the book, and maybe something that escaped me the first time I read it was a little bit more what you're talking about with Robert Cohn's character. Because as I reread it, I feel more and more like he's one of the characters that actually has a good moral compass. And it kind of like conflicts me towards the end when he starts, you know, it seems like he's almost pushed into doing bad things. And I wonder if that's happenstance or if Hemingway was actually trying to write him in more and more as an antagonist as the novel went on.
That's a really interesting point. I don't know the actual story of exactly what happened in Pamplona in 1925, but Cohen and I agree with you. I think he's not a bad person or at heart. He behaves badly because
especially toward Brett,
because he's so in love with Brett. And I think part of what my grandfather was really fascinated in was how her effect on people, on these men, and the different effects that she had on them.
Thank you so much for your call. Jim from Ocean Grove, New Jersey, left a comment on our show page asking you to elucidate the influence of Joyce and Fitzgerald on Hemingway at this time, specifically regarding the character of Cohn, a Jew like Joyce's Bloom, and a writer from Princeton like Fitzgerald.
Certainly Joyce and Fitzgerald were major influences on my grandfather at this time. He met them both in Paris at this time before writing the book. I should know, but I don't know if Harold Lowe went to Princeton, if that's a fictionalization, but of course Fitzgerald did. And certainly Joyce, my grandfather was tremendously impressed with Joyce's writing.
Well, he would have been one of the cutting-edge writers of the time, and somebody like Hemingway would, especially since he loved Gertrude Stein's writing so much. Had Three Lives already been published at that point? Has that spare prose that seems to have so influenced Hemingway.
Mm-hmm.
In The Great Gatsby, people with money can afford to be careless, and they don't seem to care about who they hurt or how much damage they do. Is there a similar idea in The Sun Also Rises with Brett in particular?
Well, she doesn't seem to care so much about money. She just uses it, and that's certainly true that she hurts a lot of people without thinking about it.
Even though she's engaged to Mike and says she's in love with Jake, Brett goes off with Pedro Romero, 19-year-old bullfighter. Why does she do that?
She doesn't seem to have a strong compass in terms of her direction, and Jake actually helps her do that. So that's where all these characters are very broken in a way.
I'm informed that Three Lives was published in 1909.
Much earlier.
Anybody who wants to understand Hemingway should read that as well. It's a great, great book. Jose Miguel left this comment on our show page. He says, I'm a listener from Pamplona, Spain, even if I live now in New York. The Sun Also Rises put my hometown on the world map. At that time, yes, he was maybe the only American there, but now the city receives thousands and thousands of Americans and other foreigners trying to enjoy as he did. And this year there were a number of gorings, people hurt by the bulls. Should we be totally pleased that Hemingway introduced outsiders to this tradition?
Well, it's hard to, that's a great problem, obviously, when you write about something, a place you love, that it might get changed in ways. But you can't really stop people from experiencing things, I think.
Stan from Queens, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like to know if your grandfather approved and liked the movie The Sun Also Rises, starring Tyrone Power, Ava Gardner, and Ella Flynn. Did he approve of the movie? And the second part of my question is, do you think deep down, because I get the opinion that maybe in some small, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but there was some form of sadism in your grandfather's writing. Am I wrong about that? Or answer both parts, please.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Well, first about the movie, I don't think he was particularly pleased with the movie, but that is across the board the case. He really didn't care for the movies that were done of his books, and as a writer, it's very hard to see characters play out your roles.
It's rare to find a writer who actually loves the movie version of their book,
mm-hmm.
because everything has to be condensed so much.
And about sadism in his writing, I think in this particular book, the book chronicles the lives of many of a whole group of people who have been damaged by World War I and various other things. I think it's a big part of the story, but I'm not sure that I would classify it as sadism.
The foreword to this edition was written by your uncle Patrick, and it focuses on what Jake Barnes reads and the writers he refers to. I'm assuming that to some degree reflects Hemingway's own reading at the time.
Yes. I mean, it's what's fascinating is that in the deleted chapters that are included in this new edition, Hemingway says, I was once Jake Barnes. So, he actually had that in up until the very last galleys of the book, that he was identifying himself with Jake. And he was a very broad reader and a lover of Turgenev.
What's the mood of the book at the end when it's just Brett and Jake in Madrid? Have both characters been damaged by the events of the preceding week?
I think, yes. I mean, I think that is a breaking point for Jake, and realizing how much he's gone against his own code, introducing Romero to Brett and helping her have an affair with him when he's still in love with her, and the love triangle complexities of this book are amazing, and I think Brett she comes across to me and people I know read her very differently, but she comes across to me as very damaged, and she's trying to make well of it, but she sees that it's not so good.
The Sun Also Rises was this month's Leonard Lopate Show Book Club selection. My great thanks to Sean Hemingway for coming by to talk about it, and this new edition that has just been published by Scribner that includes deleted chapters, corrections, fishing licenses, photographs, you name it. It's been a real pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you, Leonard. It's been a pleasure to be here.